This week on the Allegheny Front, we're going all in on energy. How we make it with either Chinese or American-made solar panels.
Our workers are going to have lots of really great jobs with products that are going to be made in the good old USA.
And if a new tariff will make a difference for solar projects in Pennsylvania. I'm Carol Holzapfel. On this week's show, we'll also look at how we move energy. Natural gas pipelines built through our region's unique topography.
So it's a breaking up of one large contiguous block into smaller pieces. And when you do that, you change the dynamics of the forest.
And built through the habitat of a very special species.
They're kind of a flattened, wrinkly-sided, beady-eyed salamander.
Those and more environmental stories about energy are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Environmental groups are asking a state agency for more time to comment on a pipeline that will eventually feed natural gas to Shell's Beaver County ethane cracker. The Falcon pipeline will be 97 miles long and run through Ohio, West Virginia, and Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports for State Impact Pennsylvania.
Shell, no! Shell, no! On a cold morning in downtown Pittsburgh, a group of protesters chanted their opposition to Shell's big chemical plant planned for the banks of the Ohio River. The protesters were outside the local office of Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, asking him to take a closer look at the impacts of the $6 billion chemical plant. Those impacts include air pollution and a significant carbon footprint. But also included in those impacts will be construction of the Falcon pipeline. Matthew Mihalik is with the Air Quality Collaborative. He says the state should extend the typical comment period for review of the Falcon permit, which runs into the thousands of pages, from 30 days to 60.
30 days is not a lot of time for people to be able to typically give quality feedback on a permit. So having some extra time, I think, would be helpful.
Shell's permit to build the Falcon comes up for public viewing just a few weeks after Pennsylvania shut down another pipeline. The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection stopped work on the Mariner East 2 after repeated permit violations, including dozens of spills along its route. Mihalik says problems with the Mariner East are why he wants the public to have more time reviewing the Falcon pipeline.
There are concerns about a large number of crossings of streams, in wetland areas, particularly because of past problems.
An analysis by the environmental data group Frack Tracker found that the pipeline route will go through more than 300 rivers and streams, and within 1,000 feet of several schools and daycare centers. Shell says the route it chose creates the least impacts to water resources and communities. The DEP says that for now, it's sticking with its 30-day comment period. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
We hear a lot about the environmental problems of natural gas transmission pipelines. Those are the big ones that cross state borders, carrying gas and other natural gas products. Construction of the Rover transmission pipeline has spilled millions of gallons of drilling mud into Ohio waterways, including pristine wetlands. And recently, New York denied a water permit for the Constitution pipeline, a decision that was recently upheld by federal regulators and brought construction to a halt. But while transmission lines get attention, there are thousands of miles of smaller pipelines being built to connect new well pads to the distribution system. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that these lines have far less oversight and could have a big impact on smaller streams and the wildlife that live there.
High school students file into Nicole Costello's small reptiles class at the Penta Career Center in Toledo, Ohio. They're learning firsthand how to foster an aquatic species that experts say is in decline, the eastern hellbender salamander. In a biosecured room on campus, 18-year-old Teresa Paff and other students clean the glass tanks, weigh and cut up worms to feed the young hellbenders they're raising. Paff picks up one that's 3 years old.
is really hard to hold. They always like to move, and they're so slimy and slippery.
These are not the cute, colorful little salamanders that might come to mind. They're brown and mottled.
Some people would say so ugly they're cute.
Greg Lipps is an expert on hellbenders at Ohio State University and works with the high school program. He says there's good reason they're often called snot otters, Allegheny alligators, and old lasagna sides.
They're kind of a flattened, wrinkly-sided, beady-eyed salamander. Everything about them is made to live underneath a big rock in tight spots and darkness.
Lipp says the adults can get big, over 2 feet long, and can live 35 years or more. They're mainly found in streams along the Appalachian Mountains in Pennsylvania and eastern Ohio. And these guys are tough. The species has survived for 1 million years, which is why Lipps was so concerned when he and a colleague found an 82% drop in their populations in Ohio. They just weren't finding many young hellbenders.
It's kind of like if the whole world became a nursing home overnight. You know that the end is near if you don't have any youngsters in these populations.
Researchers suspect the problem has to do with increased sediment in the water. Young hellbenders are thought to live in little spaces in gravel beds that are easily filled with sediment. Lipps has watched as waterways, especially in the steep hills of eastern Ohio near the Pennsylvania and West Virginia borders, have gotten muddier. The reason seems obvious to him. Pipelines.
And you can trace this. It's not rocket science when you see the muddy water to drive upstream until you see clear water and then figure out, well, what's happening? Where's the in-between? And when I've done that, it's been pipeline construction.
Back taxiing runway 24, Marshall County.
To get a better picture of the gas pipeline boom here, Ted Alk of Frack Tracker, a nonprofit that tracks the fracking industry, has organized a tour by plane of West Virginia and Ohio. As we get into the air, he's floored by how many hillsides are cleared of trees to make way for pipelines.
Look at this one, Julie. Look at how zig and zagging this puppy is.
You can see these gathering lines connecting every well pad and compressor station. Ohio and Pennsylvania are among the states with the most gathering lines in the country, each with more than 20,000 miles of them. Pipeline companies are supposed to replant the pipeline corridors, but Alk says many don't.
That's all pipeline, see? And they have not hydroseeded that. You see what I'm talking about? And they've got that apron, that tarping material that's just supposed to prevent the loading of sediment down, but they didn't hydroseed any of that.
On the ground in eastern Ohio, the hills are alive with pipeline construction. To the north are the bigger transmission lines, the Mariner East and the Rover. Smaller gathering lines have names like the Hot Sauce Hustle and Dr. Awkward. Ohio State researcher Greg Lipp says when companies strip these steep hillsides of forest for pipelines, it can destroy his team's efforts to restore stream banks and protect the habitat for eastern hellbenders and other aquatic species.
What you create is effectively what can be a river of mud every time it rains. Now, it's really a problem, and the amount of silt and sediment that can come from a pipeline cut and from an eroding stream bank is immense.
Many of the new pipelines also cross the streams themselves, like here in Captina Creek, a high-quality stream and home to hellbenders. It empties into the Ohio River. The pipeline companies either bore underneath the stream bed or dig right through the water. According to an Allegheny Front review of applications to the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, the state has issued at least 13 permits, including 66 pipeline stream crossings in the Captina Creek watershed alone since 2014. Harry Kalapolitis manages the Ohio EPA's permitting process. His agency, as required by the Clean Water Act, certifies that pipeline crossings are not going to jeopardize stream quality.
We evaluate what benefits to society it may have and weigh that against the potential impacts to water quality. Our lower bar is not jeopardizing the existing use or how that stream is performing. And we do authorize the potential lowering of water quality with potential mitigation to make up for that loss.
Kalapolitis says there's no regulation looking at the cumulative impacts of the new lines. But he says they have not seen impacts on any streams from multiple pipeline crossings.
We evaluate a lot of streams in Ohio. And, to my knowledge, we haven't had any of those reports come back to us and say that the stream is jeopardized by multiple crossings associated with pipeline projects.
Still, Kalapalaita says the Ohio EPA will propose new sediment regulations for pipelines in the coming months. And researchers at West Virginia University are starting to look at ways to reduce the environmental impacts of pipelines. Michael Strager is a professor of resource economics. In a study that just got funded, he plans to use GIS technology and drones to map pipelines in the region. And then his colleague will match the locations with water quality data in nearby streams.
So I think how our work is going to be useful is to really aid in the permitting process as part of a planning approach to really direct this industry to places where it can potentially have less of an impact than others.
Like students at the Penta Career Center, these West Virginia researchers want the waterways clean enough so species like the eastern hellbenders can survive here. The high schoolers will join experts and release the young salamanders into the streams of eastern Ohio over the summer. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
If you want to know if a new tax on imported solar panels will affect the local renewable energy market, ask an installer.
In this case, the tariff isn't going to impact them at all because they were already sold. So we're more concerned about what's going to happen going forward.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, the nuts and bolts of prioritizing American solar manufacturing. Stay tuned. We just heard about how pipeline construction could impact aquatic species. Pipelines are also affecting wildlife in forests.
It's kind of like the hidden part of gas development. It's the largest part, but very understudied.
That's Lily Langlois, a researcher at Penn State University. While Langlois was working on her PhD there, she studied aerial images to map natural gas development in Lycoming County in north central Pennsylvania. Langlois and her colleagues found that linear infrastructure, like pipelines and roads, had a bigger impact on carving up forests and affecting the wildlife habitat within them than the drilling well pads themselves. Recently, I had a chance to talk with her about the study. Can you describe the area in Lycoming County that you looked at for this study? Like, what's the forest like there? You describe it as core forest. And what's the Marcellus shale industry like there?
It's the Allegheny Plateau region, so a lot of deep valleys, a lot of steep mountains, and the forests are pretty much contiguous because there's very few people living there. There's a relatively limited road network. So in terms of wildlife, you have these hotspots of wildlife that you don't find in other parts of Pennsylvania. Something like timber rattlesnakes are locally quite abundant, but rare in the rest of the state. And prior to shale gas development, there were some activities in terms of logging, in terms of recreational activities. It's beautiful. People love to go there for canoeing, hiking, snowmobiling, you name it. But over the last 8 to 10 years, they expanded a lot of the roads that used to be there that were basically hidden and impassable by most people. And now there are two-lane highways that two semis can pass each other because that's what the shale gas industry required to build their infrastructure up there. When I first started, it was right during the boom in 2011 and 12. And that's when just your normal everyday country road up there was nonstop traffic 24 hours a day. And then things have slowly tapered off. And for the last, since 2015, I would say, very little activity has occurred. And only recently, in this last 6 months, I would say, do we see drilling activities resuming again.
And you found that forest fragmentation from these roads and also pipelines is the major threat from the Marcellus shale industry to this forested area. What do you mean by fragmentation?
Basically chopping up a large block of forest into smaller and smaller pieces. And it might not look fragmented from a human perspective because we can cross that road and go from one patch of forest to the next, but other species wouldn't necessarily be brave enough or wouldn't have the mobility to do that. So if you have a flying squirrel, this arboreal nocturnal creature, they stay within the trees and they're not going to physically be able to cross that gap of a large widened corridor. And these roads were expanded to 20, 30 meters wide, off the top of my head, 40, 50, 60 feet, depending on the type of pipeline and whether there's a road and a pipeline together. So it's a breaking up of one large contiguous block into smaller pieces. And when you do that, you change the dynamics of the forest. And by that I mean, on that forested edge where you have that road, you now have increased
solar radiation to the edge. And that changes the microclimate. So now you have drying out of the soil. Usually we consider up to 300 feet of a forested edge that has been affected, and we call that the edge effect of forest. It's no longer what used to be contiguous forest, where that sun didn't hit the forest floor and it didn't have the wind blowing in, desiccating the soil, which changes your invertebrates. And there's a whole chain effect in terms of, I specifically focus on birds, and if their invertebrates are lower in density near the forest edge, then they won't go to those areas to feed. They will avoid the forest edge. But all animals treat edges differently.
I was reading in your study that there could be higher rates of predation along these forest edges.
That's right. If you're out there in the middle of the forest bushwhacking through lots of thick mountain laurel, you will appreciate these roads and you will use them to travel because it's so much easier. And a lot of predators use that for that same reason. You've got gray foxes, raccoons, and along the edges is where they can penetrate the forest and find whether it's a nest, eggs, young, etc. We focus on the neotropical migrants. They're migrating here from Central and South America, thousands and thousands of miles. They take months to make this journey, and they come to Pennsylvania specifically and further north as well, and the forests. And they rely on these large blocks of forest away from people, away from predators. And they breed there. Their success can be impacted by fragmentation and other human disturbance.
One of the interesting things about your study is that you found there was a difference between gas development on private and public land. What is the difference and what is the impact on forests?
So in this area, within our case study of Lycoming County, about one third of it is public land. But there was a similar amount of development on both. So we were able to make this comparative study between the two and look at the systematic approach for how they built and created their infrastructure between the two landowners. And we found that public land, they hold the gas operators to a much higher and stricter level. They are a huge landowner, so they have a lot of leverage. It's not just a small private landowner that will say, okay, sure, you can put the pad on my property or not. These would say, you can put it in this region, but you cannot put it in this area because it's too close to this wetland. You know, we want to keep tourism high in this area. We don't want people to see it from Pine Creek Valley when they're down there fishing. And they also had more consolidation of infrastructure. So they had more wells per pad than what you typically find on private landowners. DCNR specifically is who we worked with the closest. And they have a whole team of geologists, foresters, lawyers, you name it, working on behalf of coordinating gas development on public land. And they were able to negotiate higher number of wells drilled per pad, because you can have up to 15, 20 wells per pad.
If you had more pads, then you would need fewer roads and fewer pipelines because they would all be in one place and you wouldn't need to spread them out.
That's right. That's right. You're able to limit the surface disturbance, but still have long lateral lines going in strategically in different directions underneath the soil. And the other thing they did is they required, whenever possible, to consolidate roads with pipelines. And because pipelines themselves are the largest portion of the industry's footprint, about 50% of the footprint is from the pipeline itself. And then once you add the roads, and now you're up to 70%. If you combine those, if you place a pipeline next to a pre-existing road, instead of creating two separate corridors that are essentially parallel to each other, you put them next to each other and you create one larger corridor, but the trade-off is less surface disturbance. And we see that occurred almost across the board. 70-80% of pipelines on public land were co-located with some sort of existing feature. Whatever they could do, they consolidated them.
Lily Langwa says the first step in changing the footprint of pipelines and forests is educating private landowners about siting them, placing them along roads, and even through fields that can be replanted with crops or shrubs that would be beneficial for wildlife. Langwa is a researcher and instructor at Penn State University, and there's more about her work at AlleghenyFront.org. You'll also find more of the stories in our Follow the Pipeline series there. That's AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Governor Tom Wolf is giving his fourth budget address on February 6th. This annual speech to the legislature lays out his priorities. At the same time, Wolf, a Democrat, is gearing up for his reelection campaign. Among other things, he's trying to portray himself as a strong environmental advocate. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick looks at how his record matches his rhetoric.
It's no secret environmentalists are frustrated with Wolf's first term. Joe Minot heads the Philadelphia-based Clean Air Council. He says Wolf has potential, but he hasn't lived up to it yet.
Well, if I were a professor and he was my student, he would get an incomplete at this point.
Other advocates, like Mark Zebist of the Natural Resources Defense Council, say Wolf could be using his bully pulpit to push for green causes, but he isn't.
I think that we're looking for Governor Wolf to show more leadership on clean energy. Obviously, there are challenges with the General Assembly as it's currently constituted, but the Assembly won't get any better without Governor Wolf pushing it.
The governor has repeatedly clashed with the Republican-controlled legislature over basic stuff. His first year in office saw a historic months-long stalemate over the state budget. Minot thinks those experiences stuck with Wolf.
I think generally the governor is afraid of the legislature.
For their part, Wolf staffers say they are working diligently in a challenging political environment to protect the natural environment. For example, last fall, Wolf signed a bill aimed at boosting solar power. He also pushed through a package of stronger regulations for Marcellus Shale gas drillers, and he banned further leasing of state park and forest land for oil and gas development. Sam Robinson is Wolf's Deputy Secretary of Policy and Planning.
It is a challenging place to work. It's a polarized space in Pennsylvania, very clearly. The governor has throughout pushed for a balanced approach to the regulation that we're doing.
But when it comes to climate change, arguably the biggest environmental issue of the day, Wolf talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk. That's according to Veronica Koptis, who heads the Western Pennsylvania-based Center for Coalfield Justice.
So it's hard to take his public commitments to action on climate change and the statements he made about the Paris Climate Accord whenever in his own state he's not actually taking real steps.
For example, Wolf hasn't followed through on a campaign pledge to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, known as REGGI. It's a market-based program among northeastern states to reduce emissions. At a recent press conference, Wolf denied ever pledging to join REGGI.
I don't remember making that promise. In fact, I do remember I didn't make that promise.
But actually, he did. It was part of his official platform, which is still visible on a cached version of his campaign website. And here's what he said back in 2014 while running for office.
I want to be part of any compact that's trying to make our air cleaner, and I think REGGI tries to do that.
Green groups have also criticized Wolf for not joining the U.S. Climate Alliance. It's a bipartisan group of state governors pushing back against President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement. Wolf is one of three Democratic governors who has not joined. He's dismissed it as symbolic, saying Pennsylvania is already on track to meet the Paris goals.
I'm not sure what is served by the symbolic gesture of signing on to something that we're already doing a better job on.
But environmentalists say his refusal to join is also symbolic. Again, here's Joe Minot of the Clean Air Council.
He doesn't seem to have taken a very strong public stance on climate change, which most people think is an existential threat to our very survival.
Minot and others say they're still hoping to see more concrete action on the environment from the governor later this year, or if he gets a second term. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A recent move by the Trump administration has some environmentalists and some in the solar industry freaking out, and others applauding. The president imposed a tariff on imported solar panels. For State Impact Pennsylvania, 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk takes a closer, more measured look at how the state's solar industry might be affected.
Surrounded by press in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump uncaps a big felt-tip marker. To sign this proclamation.
A very important executive action to protect American jobs
He imposes a 30% tax on solar panels manufactured overseas. This tariff is set to expire in 4 years, and he wants it to send a message to the rest of the world.
Our companies will not be taken advantage of anymore.
By competitors like Chinese manufacturers. See, China's government has subsidized solar manufacturing, making its panels so cheap that American companies found it difficult to compete. So they asked the federal government to impose a tariff on all foreign-made panels to level the playing field. Trump granted their wish.
And our workers are going to have lots of really great jobs with products that are going to be made in the good old USA.
But it's unclear whether those jobs are coming. The tariff could lead to more jobs in manufacturing. It could also result in more expensive solar panels. If that happens, people and energy companies might not be so keen to go solar, and that would hurt jobs in the installation side of the industry. In fact, the nation's leading solar trade group claims the tariff will kill 23,000 jobs. That's roughly a tenth of the industry's workforce. But in Pennsylvania, Ron Celentano with the State Solar Energy Industries Association paints a less dire picture.
We're certainly going to be affected by this, you know, in the state, but I don't think it will be a showstopper. It's not going to just slam the door shut.
See, Pennsylvania doesn't have solar farms with rows and rows of solar panels. Those big utility-scale installations in places like California operate on tight margins. A slight change in price could break a project. Most solar installations here are small. Think rooftops of homes and buildings. Celentano says those customers are motivated by more than just price.
People are just getting more on board with wanting to do solar.
Because it's clean, emissions-free energy, and they may be open to paying more for it. As for the cost, analysts at Bloomberg expect the tariff will lead to a 3% price increase in residential solar installations. And these projects don't come cheap. Here at the new Forest Hills Municipal Building near Pittsburgh, over 400 solar panels cover the rooftop. Workers from the local solar installer Energy Independent Solutions are finishing up the wiring inside. Hal Saville helped develop this nearly $400,000 system. The panels come from an American-owned company, but they were made in Mexico.
In this case, the tariff isn't going to impact them at all because they were already sold. So that's a good thing. So we're more concerned about what's going to happen going forward.
Whether the tariff will make projects like this unaffordable. I caught up by phone with the president of Saville's company to talk about this. Joe Morinville says when rumors about a potential tariff began to circulate in late 2016, companies with projects in the works stocked up on panels.
They bought everything the market had available because they didn't want to get stuck, you know, buying these modules at a 30% tariff.
He noticed prices for some parts climbed 26% before Trump even announced the tariff. So he's not anticipating a major swing in price going forward because it has already happened. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. You can find all of those episodes at trumponearth.org. I'm Kara Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.